Gabriel program. You are cleared for departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
Is your 50,000 watt sports leader from Fresno, the Central Valley, and for Game of Thrones fans feeling left out on this radio program? I'll address that in a moment. 940 ESPN, 940 ESPN Fresno.com. Your 2-hour morning tour begins right now, 3 minutes, 29 seconds past the hour of 7 a.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time. Good morning to you. I am the host of this program and none other that I am aware of. Christopher Gabriel, gorgeous morning here in the Central Valley. We had a little bit of rain. It's going to be a little bit cooler the next couple of days. I am in heaven. It's the CG zone, folks, 20 to 70. Anything above and below, I get a little cranky. Technical director, producer, hockey guy, Sharks fan, Giants fan, Russ, keeping us going in the right direction. On the program this morning, our weekly encore, it's going to be Tim Kuehn. That was a great conversation with him yesterday on a piece that he wrote about 6 years ago, Death of a Sports Town, talking about Oakland, and then fast-forwarding to today, and just the irony that he was in Oakland, as we were talking to him yesterday, covering, he's not really covering the Warriors-Blazers series, he's doing a different feature on an aspect of that series, but it was interesting to talk to him about Oakland, the team's leaving, the team maybe staying, meaning the A's, culturally and so on. If you missed it, give it a listen. It's really good. I always say that it's good because of what he had to say. It's just compelling stuff. 8:05, we'll talk with Tony Landry out on the East Coast, talk a little bit about the PGA Championship. Nick Shager at 8:35, and one more thing, excuse me, at 8:55 this morning. Warriors win last night, 114-111. It pretty much, the game, I said that it was going to be a different game. It was a different game. I thought that they would win. Coach Q looking real good right now, saying that he thinks it's going to be a sweep. I thought the series would go seven. I simply do not believe this. The Warriors are going to win the NBA title. Unless Curry or Thompson goes out, they're going to win. But I told you that I think it was, really went without saying that you were going to see a different Portland team last night. They had a chance to acclimate, get their feet wet in this series, completely remove everything that was in their heads and bodies from the seven-game series that they had with Denver playing a game seven at altitude. Of course, their guards, their backcourt was going to play better last night. But the Warriors at one point down 17, down 15 at the half, and then the Warriors just did what they do, didn't they? I mean, they just did what they do. With 9-11 to go in the third, they were down 13. With 7-11 to go in the third, they were down 3. And then to Portland's credit, I mean, they fought back. And with 4:16 to go, they're up 8. And you're probably thinking, if you don't watch the Warriors that much, you're probably thinking, especially if you're a Warriors hater, which there are a lot of, which is a testament to how great they are, you're thinking, okay, we're going to have a 1-1 series lead. And then again, the Warriors did what they do. Final 4:16, they outscore Portland 14-3. The final possession, brilliant defense by Andre Iguodala, making Dame Lillard lose control of the ball. And then when he tried to go up for a three, slapped it away. Didn't look like there was a foul. Tough angle to see, but just looking at the arm movement, the body language, it didn't seem like he got him there. But Curry goes for 37. It was fun watching him and his brother, Seth Curry, go at it, and the shots of the parents. You can only imagine, right? I mean, you can only imagine what that's like. My two kids are 3.5 years apart. They both, play athletics. It's unlikely that they'll ever go at each other, but I see the competitive things that they have in different ways, and just to see these two guys at the highest level of the game going at it, that was cool. So, I left out 7:23 to 7:24. Nick Anderson's going to be joining me. My apologies. I didn't have it on my list in front of me, even though I've got it on my list to my right. Nick Anderson, part of the Zone on Fridays with Nick Papagni. I'm told that Nick Anderson now going with the nickname Big Cat. And I'm not sure where that comes from. I'm not sure if Pags gave that to him or what. We're going to have to get to the bottom of this. So, Sunday, the 8th and final season of Game of Thrones comes to a close. And there's a change.org petition that right now, as of this morning, has more than 350,000 signatures wanting the producers of the program to remake the final season with competent writers. Good luck with that. I guess a lot of people are upset. I don't watch the show. It's not one that I've been dialed into. I certainly know kind of what it's about, and I've seen little bits and pieces, but I've not really stayed with it. But that's not what I want to talk about this morning in terms of that. It's endings. Because here in our building, there's a split crowd. The crowd is, I can't live without Game of Thrones. What am I going to do after Sunday, May 19th? There's that crowd. And then there's the other crowd that says, I am sick of Game of Thrones and I can't wait for this to be done. Go away. See you later. And I think there's a lot that we can understand from this, and we see a lot of it in sports, in football in particular. When it comes to shows, though, I mean, we get attached to our shows, right? We don't want them to end. Go back a few years or a couple of decades. MASH. The final episode of MASH, it seemed like all of North America was watching MASH. And was Hawkeye going to kiss Hot Lips? You know, it seems funny to even say that sentence now, but that's where we were at. All in the Family. You know, Edith and Archie Bunker. And then that show came to an end, and I don't remember if it was they killed off Edith or Gene Stapleton around that time died, if I'm remembering it right. I may not be. But the point is, they tried to bring that back as Archie's place. And he had a niece, you know, with Meathead and his daughter, you know, Sally Struthers, but it just never really worked. But we didn't want that show to end. We had the Jeffersons next door, which ended up, you know, having a spinoff. We didn't want the show to end. It was that way with Friends, wasn't it? It was that way with Seinfeld in particular. And then you have all these other series that either are still going or came to an end, and we didn't want that to happen. There's series like House of Cards. And of course, there's a whole other side of that with Kevin Spacey, Arrested Development, The Walking Dead, Orange is the New Black. You had Downton Abbey. Downton Abbey fans, and then you had the crowd with that, right? You had the fans. I was one of them who loved the show because I love period dramas. And you had the other half saying, it's a snooty British show. Why do I want to watch something like this? But I really believe that when you look at something like Game of Thrones and how polarizing it is, you know, with the side that doesn't want it to end, the side that does want it to end, and the side that does want it to end, by and large, they've never watched it. It's like football. Look at football. Look at how annoyed, frustrating, almost despondent some fans get after the Super Bowl. And you can go back to the 70s and see that there were people with lots of money that understood this and said, people don't want football to end. So what are we going to do? Let's create a new league. Let's keep football going forward. And back in the 70s and 74 and 75, you had what? You had the World Football League. That didn't work. They thought it was going to work. It didn't work. Then you in the 80s, you had the USFL. And then more recently, a number of years back, not too many years back, you had the XFL. That failed. Then this year, we had the Alliance of American Football. That failed with 2 weeks to go in the regular season. We're going to have the XFL again next year. And then, oh, let's not forget, in 1989, you had 1998, my mistake. You had NFL Europe. You know, the NFL Europe League or NFL Europe, and that lasted until about 2006. We for a number of different reasons, you'll hear the people who have started these various leagues tell us all the reasons why they feel that having more football is going to be a good thing. But really, I think you can see that going into the reason that I gave you, and that is we don't want things to end. Look at relationships. I mean, divorces, boyfriend, girlfriend, friendship, things end, and they're always painful on one level or another. And there's reasons that both sides have. But when a marriage ends, when a relationship ends, whether it's a friendship or a boyfriend and girlfriend, what do? You don't just stop. You eventually go and look for another relationship or another friendship, or you start another friendship. And in football, it's the same thing. And I think in TV, it's the same thing. And in the case of Game of Thrones, I mean, I get it. It hasn't been a show that's grabbed me. At some point, I'll probably sit down and watch it. But we get attached to our shows like we get attached to football. I'm thinking about people in this building who have where we broadcast from who are it really is such a mixed bag. And it reminds me of soccer when the World Cup comes around, when the Olympics come around. That's when you really hear people talking about it most. Yeah, we have the USL here. We have the Foxes. And, they didn't make the playoffs last year, but they've got a good foundation going forward. And, of course, you have the Major League Soccer. You have the MLS, which has been very successful. Look at Atlanta. They're getting 40,000 and 50,000 people a game in Mercedes-Benz Stadium. You see them pack them in at StubHub Center down in Los Angeles. But for some reason, like Game of Thrones, like TV shows, we have people with soccer that they just, you either have the people who love soccer who will talk your ear off and go overboard because they're sensitive to the fact that the other side can't stand soccer. And for some reason, and I mean, I've gone on and on about this over the years. For some reason, if you're not a soccer fan, if you're not in that crowd, if you don't care about the Premier League, the Champions League, you know, if you don't know what UEFA means, if you don't care about the MLS or the USL or any other acronym where they're playing with a ball on a field or a pitch, you feel compelled to rip the people who do like it. It's a dynamic I don't get, but I've seen that with Game of Thrones now. Seen it with Game of Thrones. I guess the question that I would have with Game of Thrones, again, speaking as someone who's not been dialed into the show, is what is it about this show? What is it about this show that grabs you or seems to have grabbed you more than just about any other Netflix or HBO series that has been out there for some time now? Because it's fascinating to me. You know, but this change.org petition, but my first thought when I saw that is, are there anybody petitioning the Alliance? Is anybody emailing the league offices saying, we really want you back? Well, of course they're not. Because that's gone away like a show that died. You know that when Game of Thrones goes down, there's going to be something else. And then there's going to be something else like Game of Thrones. Because no different than HGTV, and you have the house flipping shows, and you started that with, I forget which one, you have the Property Brothers, and then you've got the married couple down in Chip and Joanna Gaines down in Waco, and you've got about 180 other of those types of shows now on HGTV and DIY, and then you have the cooking shows on Food Network and Cooking Channel, and you have how many of those shows? And you had American Idol, and then The Voice, and America's Got Talent, and Britain's Got Talent, and Bulgaria's Got Talent, and Bolivia's Got Talent, Guam's Got Talent. You know, show after show after show. Survivor, there hasn't really been anything that's rivaled that, although Big Brother's out there, Not Big Brother. The Amazing Race? Is that still a thing? But sooner or later, because when somebody makes money off something, and nobody makes more money than the National Football League, no, I mean, just the way it is, there's always going to be an investor, a couple, or more than a few people who say, I can make this work. I've got the magic key here to make this work. So Game of Thrones has been a massive success, and I don't know what it's going to be, but somebody out there in Hollywood is going to say, I've got an idea. It's based loosely on Game of Thrones, because that's what they do. They do it with sports, primarily with football. Why is it that, you know, we have other football leagues, but you don't see any other baseball? Well, you see baseball in Asia. But you don't see other groups trying to rival baseball, because that would fail miserably. They're in hockey. There was the WHL, the World Hockey League. I'm trying to remember what it was called. The Hartford was in it at first. There were a couple of other teams. Gordie Howe played in that league. WHA, the World Hockey Association. That's who it was. But they lasted a little while. The Houston Aeros had a team. There were about six or eight teams, something like that. Basketball, well, there's not going to be another league. There was the ABA, and then they merged into the NBA, but there's not going to be another league now that's going to go after the NBA. There's just, they know it's not going to work. But for football, for some reason, there's always somebody out there or a group that believes that they can make it go. And it's no different in Hollywood. We're going to see something that's like Game of Thrones in the next couple of years. Maybe it's something I'll ask Nick Shager about. Maybe there's something already in production. I'm not sure. Are you one of the, which side of the fence are you on? Are you in the I can't live without Game of Thrones crowd? Or are you in the I am sick of Game of Thrones crowd? Are you in that crowd? You're in one or the other. I know you are. One or the other. Because you know, you're also in the I hate soccer, I love soccer, and you're also in the I need more football. Give me more football. I'll take spring football. I wanted the alliance to work. It didn't work. Now I can't wait for the XFL because I know that's going to be great. You're in there somewhere. Coming up, we're going to talk with Nick Anderson for a couple of minutes about his show. His show and Nick Papagni. It is The Zone. They've been on sabbatical for a few weeks. Not sure where they went. Some sources telling me they were on a cruise. Others tell me they were on assignment up in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Not sure what that's about. Maybe they were lobstering together. I'm not really sure. Nick will explain all of that coming up. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Coming up in a couple of minutes, our encore of the week, Tim Kuehn, ESPN the magazine. We talked about Oakland as a city, as a sports town. Is the city of Oakland dying? He wrote a great piece 6 years ago called Death of a Sports Town, and Tim's been on this program a number of times, and I had him come on again because he was in Oakland doing a feature on I can't tell you what it is, but it's going to come out soon, but it's in the realm of the Warriors, the NBA, and so on, and I wanted him to revisit this piece a little bit. Interesting how many things he talked about 6 years ago that have come to fruition or are still hanging in the balance. One thing that is no longer hanging in the balance, you know, we've wondered where Nick and Nick have been. They host The Zone Fridays 4 to 6, sometimes a little earlier because of Fresno State baseball. Nick Anderson joining me right now. Nick, good morning to you.
CG, good morning. How are you, my friend?
Doing very well. So I said that, you know, my sources have told me that you and Pags have been everything from you're at Fenway, you're on a cruise, you've been in Halifax, you know, doing lobster trapping. Where have you been? What's going on? And where's the new show or the old show going to be in a new location?
You know, I do like the lobster part. I wouldn't mind doing that. Unfortunately, we were not there, but yeah, we got a lot of great things going on. We've been on what Pegs refers to as location the last few weeks, if not a little bit longer. We've been looking for a location to air the show, and we found a great place that has a great atmosphere with wonderful people that are in there. We've been in there a few different times throughout the day and evenings just to kind of check it out, and that is Blast and Brew in Old Town Clovis, CG.
Yeah, I've been there. It's a good place. It's a fun place, certainly. Is the show changing at all, or are you guys going to still kind of, you know, do a buffet's worth of sports?
We're just going to be hitting everything. We're going to try to focus entirely as much as we can on the local scene, as you well know, and mainly a lot of the high school things. Is when high school ends, it gets kind of interesting, so we kind of move around a little bit, start talking about some of the local football because that's starting to fuel up. For the most part, Fresno State and a lot of high school, and that's really what Pags has been doing the last few weeks, and he's really the man behind the scenes on this show. I'm just kind of the tag along, the guy in the background that kind of laughs every now and then and says a few things and keeps them contained, but mainly high school, and we've got a lot of great things we're going to talk about today. We've got a state champion coming on the swim side. I don't want to give away everything on the show today because Pags will be tweeting that out later, but we've got a wonderful agenda for this afternoon, and that's going to be 3:30. And you said it perfectly. We get kind of jockeyed around this time of year, depending on the Giants or the Bulldogs.
Yeah, it's we on my program. I'm sure you know we joke with the Giants that we've got the car wash edition of the program, which comes on at, you know, we come on at 3:05 and 3:25. We're saying see you later, hello John Miller, because especially when they go out on the East Coast or somewhere else, and then Fresno State, same thing. The last couple of shows have been we've been done at 5:30. Because of that, or because of Honor Flight coming in at the airport. So you're going to talk a little. You know, it's funny because we're all going to be going through this in a couple of weeks, where with the NBA playoffs are over, the Stanley Cup playoffs are over, and maybe the Sharks are going to find their way in. We'll see about that. We're in that sort of DMZ in July and early August. There's like a 6-week period where we might as well be talking about the World Bog Snorkeling Championships or breaking down curling, because there's just not a lot. You guys ever feel that on your program?
Well, I'm telling you, we do it once a week. Pax does it twice, but you're doing it every day, my friend. So I know there's a lot more to what you do than what we do in terms of planning and trying to find topics every day. So I'm sure that's a challenge, but you're absolutely right. It's tough. Once the playoffs are over, baseball's kind of there, but you know, baseball's baseball. You can grab on to a few things, but as far as all the controversy and things that go on, it seems like that stays with football and basketball in some cases. I mean, I love hockey, so I try to keep up with hockey a little bit. I know that's a sport that you love, and I know Russ behind the scenes right now is probably shaking his head because I know he loves hockey as well.
Well, that's very true, because we're very much dialed in, and that game four tonight in St. Louis is going to be terrific. Of course, right here on 940 ESPN, Dan Rusinowski has the call. Hey, Nick, before we go, give folks all the details you need to know to come out and check you and Nick Papagni out. We call him Pag Meter. By the way, before you do that, where did Big Cat come from?
You know, Big Cat was a name that I think Pags somehow or another threw at me, and I'm just going to go with that. That's all I'm going to say.
All right. There's a lot of mystery behind that. Okay. Because,
yeah,
well,
I'm sure.
All right. Good deal. So, hey, Nick, give folks all the details you need to know to come check you guys out.
Well, Blast and Brew, downtown Clovis. And stay tuned to Pag's Twitter. He's got everything on there, as you well know, people that follow him right now. He talks all day. So keep in tune. He'll have the agenda up probably in the next few hours. And we're going to start down there at 3:30 p.m. today. That's our tip-off, 3:30 p.m. Come on down. We're going to give away some Giants tickets. CG, we'd love to have you come down as well, and we'd love to be we'll talk about you as well, and we want to go back and forth. And when we get down to that lull, I'm sure we can share some things and try to keep that dead period going.
Well, you know, when you think about me, just think about the dead period. Just the, you know, because it's just, you know.
Well, talking about dead periods, the dead periods in NCAA basketball these days. We'll talk a little bit about that today as well.
Outstanding. All right, Nick, always a pleasure, folks. Nick Anderson, part of Nick Papagni. You know him as Pag Meter. And Nick Anderson, now the mysterious name of Big Cat, and they are going to be live at out in Clovis at Old Town at 3:30 today. Keep an eye on at Pag Meter. You'll see his tweets everywhere, because as Nick said, because of Fresno State baseball with the Giants, whatever, sometimes they're starting at 3:30, sometimes they're starting at 4. Today it's at 3:30, and they are also right here on 940 ESPN. Nick, have yourself a great day and a great show today.
Appreciate you, CG. Thanks, you too.
Absolutely. There you go. Coming up, our encore of the week, Tim Kuehn from ESPN The Magazine. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Glad you're hanging out with us. Getting ready for game two tonight up at Oracle Arena. Blazers and Warriors should be a great series. A lot of overreaction after the first game. Oh, it's going to be a short series. I don't think so. You're going to see that backcourt of McCollum and Lillard adjust. They're definitely going to push their defense out. They're not going to mess up on the pick and rolls. You're going to see a very different series. There's going to be one man in that arena tonight, one of my favorite writers. Love having him on the program. He is from ESPN, the magazine, and he wrote really a compelling piece from 6 years ago. I read it, and I'm struck by where the city of Oakland is at now as opposed to where it was when he wrote Death of a Sports Town. Welcoming back to the CGP, Tim Kuehn. Tim, how are you?
Hey, I'm great, Christopher. How are you?
Doing very well. You know, I wish I was up where you are tonight doing the show up there, but you're going to have a great time. You know, I mentioned the piece that you wrote, and it's a wonderful piece, and you wrote about how sports in America have changed, meaning how we attend games, where we attend games, and this almost ritualistic standard that's now set or that's been set by generations of fans. Well, the whole paradigm has changed, and you wrote this. You said the soul of a place meant nothing. Decades of loyalty meant nothing. Every paying customer became a walking barcode, and the worth of a city became the NASDAQ valuation of the companies leasing the luxury suites. The experience of going to a game changed from a communal celebration, the only common ground for gangbangers and cops, truants and teachers, to something completely different. Tim, an argument can be made that nowhere has that been more evident than Oakland. Where has, from when you wrote that to now, where has this whole thing gone wrong there?
Well, I you know, Christopher, it's an interesting topic because so many things have gone wrong, and yet the basis of all this, the fact that the Raiders are leaving and the Warriors are leaving, the basis of it is correct, in which the city is not going to bankrupt itself once again for a sports franchise. And I think that you know what struck me in sitting in the arena on Tuesday night, I was looking around and I was just seeing what a remarkable cross section of this city attends these games, and it's rare that in that regard. This is a very diverse crowd. It's everybody's represented. It feels like Oakland in the Coliseum Arena or Oracle Arena when the Warriors are playing. And I was just thinking as I was looking around, like I'd like to take a picture and then take a picture from the same spot next year in the Chase Arena in San Francisco and just see how different it's going to be when, you know, the ticket prices are going to be exorbitant and it's going to be in San Francisco. It's going to attract an entirely different crowd, very similar to what happened in a, you know, even though the Giants stayed within the same city when the team moved from Candlestick to Oracle Park, it changed the dynamic. The people there were there for the scene in many ways, and they were not there. They weren't the same people that were at Candlestick, and these people won't be the same lifelong Warrior fans over there in San Francisco. And I just think, you know, something's lost in that, where it's become stratified in ways that the rest of our society has become. You know, your worth is based on where you sit in an arena. And I don't know. I just think that, you know, I don't know how sustainable it is. I mean, the Warriors have built their own stadium on their own land over in San Francisco, so they didn't ask for a handout. But you know, the Raiders leaving and the A's hopefully getting a stadium down here by the water will serve to mitigate a little bit of it from that time when I was writing that piece. But yeah, there's something lost. There's some spirit of a place that's lost when it changes this way and it becomes strictly financial.
Well, it's really so well said. My guest is Tim Kuehn, ESPN the magazine, because I'll tell you, Tim, and this is one of the reasons why I was so struck by your piece, is that I'm a Chicagoan, and my family came from the South Side. So we were always White Sox fans, and I still am. And I can tell you, when Jerry Reinsdorf and Eddie Einhorn built the new Comiskey across 35th Street, it might as well have been in another state, because what was a very different crowd, it was a beer and bratwurst crowd, has turned into basically wine spritzers and quiche. And I mean, it's the fabric of who the White Sox have always been, those fans that used to be able to afford first base and third base are now barely in the bleachers. So your point is well taken. And when I look at Oakland, I mean, it is a city that in many ways, for the past 10 years, certainly 6 years from when you wrote the piece, is kind of reinventing themselves. They're getting on lists now, and they're viewed as a much more progressive city in terms of, you know, attracting more of an edgy crowd. But they've also wanted to cling to what's represented the fabric of the city, which you laid out so well. I mean, the very best and at times the worst of Oakland, the Raiders, the A's, the Warriors, the image of all three of those, Tim, I mean, they defined Oakland for decades. Has this been a city that is what you're saying? Has this been a city essentially at war with itself in terms of how they wanted to market themselves to the masses, except they were always sort of butting up against the image that was defined and redefined by the teams that represented the city?
And I think, you know, Christopher, I think Oakland has always been defined by outsiders, you know, rather than the people who are here. And this is a very vibrant place. I mean, it's had its problems. It's had its financial problems in the schools. It's had its crime problems. But there's a heart, there's a beating heart of this city that is just very proud and very accomplished. And, you know, I think you'd be hard pressed to find another city that has the loyalty among the guys who have made it. And I think about Marshawn Lynch, who's kind of the gold standard for that, who has given back so much to this place. Damian Lillard, who you know, is playing this week, you know, in the Oracle Arena and trying to close it down, as it were. I think that there's such a pride there that they represent this city even when they're not here. And I think that, you know, what the city's become, it's like every place in the Bay Area, it's becoming more gentrified. And so people are getting displaced from their lifelong generational homes. You know, Marshawn, by the way, is combating that by buying properties and renting it back to the people who live there rather than kicking them out. So, you know, the Bay Area is such a fascinating place in terms of the property values have so much of an impact on what a place becomes. And I think that what Oakland is, it has always been embodied by these teams and by the fact that even though they're considered the stepbrother to San Francisco, they had three teams and they could go toe to toe. And the A's fans up until recently could say they had more World Series than Giants fans. And, you know, Raider fans could argue with 49er fans and all that. And I think that when it's gone, I mean, it's not going to change this city dramatically. It's still going to be an attractive place to live. The rents are still going to get higher. The tech companies are still going to want to be here. But there's going to be some fabric that's torn when these two teams leave here. And I think it's maybe more important to a city this size than it would be to a Chicago or a Los Angeles.
Well, I think you're right. And I mean, Tim, I was living in Minneapolis when there was talk of contracting the Twins and the Expos. And I was in the Midwest doing this program when there was all the arguing in St. Paul at the State House over whether or not to, you know, whether the Vikings should stay or not. You mentioned Damian Lillard, you know, who obviously a very proud Oakland native. You saw him in the press conference with his Oakland A's jersey, and he said, and this is what he said to you: I don't think people realize how big of a deal it would be if those teams weren't there. Those stadiums are our getaway. If we went to a football game, it was the Raiders, a baseball game, the A's, a basketball game, the Warriors. If they're gone, it takes away more than just teams. Close quote. And Tim, that's it, isn't it? Because a lot of folks, the owners, the ownership groups, they're interested in the luxury suites. They're interested in great tax deals for a city, and they forget that these teams do matter to a city and to a region. In Minneapolis, when I was there, if the Vikings left, what was going to get lost in that was the entire state, every mom and pop sporting goods store from the Boundary Waters to the southern border were going to have, you know, all their inventory gone because there was nothing to sell. And Tim, I think when teams leave, I think that is one of the things that's really lost on owners, because it is lost on the people with their teams aren't there anymore.
It is, Christopher, and I think what you're getting at is that, you know, we can overemphasize the importance of these games, but I think that there is an importance on the fact that they exist and that these franchises are here and that they represent something to the people who support them. And, you know, there hasn't been a fan base more loyal than the Warrior fan base. I mean, these people have been here when it was Vontigo Cummings and, you know, Joe Barry Carroll and whoever. No matter how bad they were, the people showed up at this arena, and it was a culture. And the very fact of the matter right now is that they are leaving because San Francisco represents a better investment. And that's what is difficult to handle, is that someone like Joe Lacob, who really doesn't have, he has recent ties to this area, but he's not from here. So he comes in and he sees his ego can be stroked by this billion-dollar arena on the waterfront over in San Francisco. And it's great. It's going to be beautiful, and everyone's going to ooh and ah about it. But there are going to be a lot of kids over here in Oakland who maybe got to go to one game a year, or maybe got to go to a game, an A's game or three A's games because they read a certain number of books in school, who are going to be – they're not going to have that connection to the Warriors. They're not going to be able to say that they went inside there. That's what Damian Lillard's talking about. He got to go inside there. He got to see those guys. He got to root for Vontigo Cummings, you know, and that – sparked something in him. And whether it was, you know, I mean, we're not saying that these guys are going to become NBA players or these kids are all striving for that, but there's something about seeing success and seeing success that looks like you that is very important, that is going to be a loss here. It's going to be a significant loss.
Well, you're absolutely right. My guest is Tim Kuehn from ESPN The Magazine. That would be a perfect segue for you to share the Kenny Shedd story. When I read this, this was the moment that I knew I've got to get Tim back on the program, about the, you know, the young boy and the 8x10 black and white photograph. I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah. So Kenny Shedd is a former Oakland Raider wide receiver of very little renown. I think if I remember correctly, I think he had 16 catches for the team, and he went on to become a San Leandro police officer. And obviously, San Leandro is just adjacent to, just south of Oakland. He responded to a call of a distraught kid, in a high school kid, I believe. I don't have the speech
right,
in front
yes.
of me. And he went into the room to talk to this kid, and he just couldn't believe his eyes, because there was a framed photo of Kenny Shedd while he was playing with the Raiders on the wall of this kid's bedroom. And Kenny talked to the kid and tried to help him. And when he went out, he talked to his partner and he said, "You got to go in there and tell me I'm not crazy. Tell me that he's got my number 84, I believe it was, on the wall in there." So his partner went in and came out and said, "You know, that's it. You're not crazy." So he ended up talking to him, or I think an intermediary might have told the kid, "Hey, you know who that is?
Yeah.
This guy that just was in your room is the guy on your wall." And that kid, it made such an impact on this kid, and that he kept in touch with him, and he kept, like, Kenny Shedd talks about how every once in a while one of his officers would come up to him and say, "Hey, remember the kid from you know, your picture? He says to say hi and that he's doing well." And it's just little things like that you lose. I mean, that's one story about one kid from one really, you know, lightly accomplished professional athlete in this area. And it may have changed that kid's life. I mean, it sounds sort of, you know, utopian and Pollyanna to talk about things like this, but that's what you lose when that team leaves, is that connection to the community and that possibility, that idea that person could change somebody's life, regardless of what he thinks of himself or what he played as a player. Just the fact that he was in this city in that uniform meant something to that kid.
You're so right. And in your piece, you include the Kenny Shedd comment that I thought really supports everything that you've laid out when he says the Raiders were his team, not necessarily me, but I became the face of it. Remove that, and we have a kid with very few positive role models. It's something I see every day. And I mean, that completely confirms what you're saying. And, you know, you also brought up something that those of us who have been to Oakland many times, and certainly plenty of people here, Tim, who were born and raised in the Bay Area or the East Bay, you know, there is this chasm with the hills and the flatlands, different parts of the same community that define this this dichotomy that is Oakland. But Oakland isn't alone. When you talk about these cities, as you well know, stadiums, communities, Detroit had that issue, Cleveland had the issue, Baltimore did as well, Washington. I mean, the thing that I wonder is if it's out of control now is all of these cities have built new stadiums except for Oakland. Of course, L.A., the Dodgers, but Dodger Stadium will never go away, Fenway Park, Wrigley. But all these cities have built new stadiums. And at what point, Tim, does that cycle stop? Because then we see new stadiums being built 20 years later because the current new one that's not new anymore doesn't have enough luxury suites, doesn't have enough amenities, bells and whistles. And at some point, it becomes so much more about, you know, the separating the A group from the B group, those real fans you talked about in Oakland, where the crowds don't look the same. They don't look like they used to. And I think the more these stadiums are being built, Tim, I understand it's the way of the world, the bigger the divide we're going to have.
No, that's very true. And I also think that there, you know, you say, where does this end? And you know, Texas is one example that the Rangers are getting a new stadium after not very long. You know, in Atlanta, they built a new stadium for the Braves after, you know, 22 years of the other one, and after the Olympics. And, you know, there are many reasons in many places, but most of the time it's simply greed. And I think that is what, you know, that obviously when a decision is made on greed, the people who are left behind are the people who have the least. And, you know, but you look at San Francisco and we talk about these casual fans or these, you know, the selfie fans who go to the game so that they can just prove that they were there. You know, look what happens when that team is bad, like right now. I mean, they're in the throes of three really bad seasons and there aren't many people there. I mean, they have a season ticket base that they're never going to announce fewer than, I think, 26,000 at a game. But all you have to do is watch a game and see that there are fewer than 26,000 at these games. And that's the risk you run when you maybe move from the Oakland Coliseum Arena, to use the old term, over to Chase Arena or Chase, whatever they're calling it in San Francisco, is that right now it looks great and everybody's going to go see Steph Curry. But in 5 or 8 years, when, you know, the reincarnation of Vontigo Cummings is the guy that's starting at point guard over there, it may not look the same. I mean, people are only going to love an arena as long as the team that's in it, you know, is lovable.
Yeah, no, that's very well said. One more thing for you, and you need to get back to work. We're talking with Tim Kuehn covering the he's doing something. We're not really sure, but he's doing something, probably a feature story, something really cool that's going to be about 12 pages, and you can't put it down. Tim Kuehn is up at Oracle Arena, going to be taking in Blazers and Warriors tonight. Tim, Monday, Port of Oakland commissioners voted to start talks to allow this new baseball stadium for the A's to be built. But, you know, there's going to have to be an environmental impact report. They're going to give them, I think, 4 years for that. There, of course, is a group that is against it, the East Oakland Stadium Alliance, that has business owners in it, baseball fans. They want more thought being put into it. They really tried to rally the Port of Oakland commissioners not to push this thing forward. So given your background in terms of knowing this story, knowing a lot of the fabric of Oakland, do you see the city, the team, do you see it all getting done, whether it's Howard Terminal or somewhere else, that the A's get a stadium, or do you think ultimately they're going to be out of Oakland as well?
You know, Christopher, I'll choose to be a little bit utopian on this, and I think that the Warriors and the Raiders factor into this as well. I really do think something will get done. I think that for the first time there is sort of is incentive to get it done. I think both sides really want to get it done. I think Oakland needs to get it done. I mean, they have sort of chosen the A's. They've chosen the team that has 81 home games. They've chosen, you know, the volume over the Raiders when they had the opportunity to give Mark Davis whatever he wanted. They're not going to give the A's everything they want, and the A's understand that. So I think that there is an agreement that if they can move forward on this site, that it will happen. I think there's a lot of hurdles to overcome. I mean, there would be a lot of hurdles to overcome if they were just going to tear down the Coliseum and rebuild. But I think the fact that they're going to a new site that has environmental issues, that has, it has a built-in economy there with the port that might be disrupted. There's going to be opposition. I think, though, that in the end something will get done in Oakland with the A's, because I just don't think either side – I don't think the A's have a better option, and I don't think that Oakland can afford to lose them. So, you know, that could change by next week, but I do think that they are going forward. The new A's president seems very upbeat and positive about what he's doing, and seems legitimately committed to this area. A ballpark down there, it's, you know, not very far from where I'm sitting right now, would be just glorious. I mean, it would be a great spot. It would rival what is across the bay, and I think that's probably the end goal for the A's.
He is Tim Kuhn, ESPN The Magazine. If you have not read his work, you are missing a lot. You can find him on Twitter, at Tim Kuhn, ESPN, TimKeown, ESPN. Tim, it's always great to visit with you. I appreciate your time. I know you're busy this afternoon. Enjoy the game tonight, and we'll look forward to having you back soon.
Hey, thanks, Christopher. I enjoyed it, as always.
All righty. There you go. Tim Kuhn, his work is really so good. 1 hour in the books. Hour number two is coming up next. We will talk with an elite sports mind, a good friend, and an occasional Shakespearean scholar, Tony Landry, producer of Big Ten This Morning on Sirius XM. PGA Championship is in day two. That means round two, of course, for you rookies. And we will pick his brain about that. And sources tell me that he's driving up the New England Thruway as we speak. I can't imagine what he's doing or where he's going. He'll have to tell us. Glad you're hanging out with us. This is the CGP.
Studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number two of your two-hour Friday morning tour begins right now. 3 minutes, 42 seconds past the hour of 8 a.m. Pacific. Daylight saving time. That makes it just a few minutes after 11 a.m. on the New England Thruway, although I'm not sure that I'm supposed to give out the location. He could be anywhere. Tony Landry could be anywhere on I-95 from the Washington, D.C. area up to Boston. I'm not really sure. He's going to go right by the city that I lived in. He's going to go right by the suburb that I lived in. What a great feeling it must be for him. We welcome to the program my good friend, Mr. Tony Landry. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you doing this fine, overcast Maryland mid-morning?
Well, I'm doing well, and I know that you're going to be driving north at some point, and I was just saying, as you overheard, that it's got to be a great thrill for you that you're going to drive right by where I used to live when I lived outside of New York City, when I moved out to Rye, New York. And in case you're wondering, Rye was founded in 1660. It looks like a little Charles Dickens town, and it is the practice home for the New York Rangers. They play at Playland, which is the big amusement park that you saw in the movie Big.
You know, I'm probably going to get yelled at for this, but I have still never seen the movie Big. So when I drive by, I will have somebody document some, at least take a photo for me so I can have something to compare it to.
What the hell is wrong with you? How could you not have seen? Now, wait a minute. You give me grief for daring to put a jersey on, and yet you've not seen Big?
I feel like those are two very, very separate arguments that we could make.
Oh, I'm going to conflate
them. Tom Hanks playing a piano with his feet, and a grown man wearing that, especially a hockey jersey that you trolled me with nonetheless, sir. These are two very different things.
All right. Well, I can always fall back on your profile picture on Twitter, which is you and, is it the fan dressed as Gritty or is it Gritty?
I've just come to refer to that man as real life Gritty.
All right.
I think they probably wanted that guy to be Gritty, and he's, yeah, no, I'm going to go ahead and wear. If you look at that picture, and I don't know if you can see it or not, but that guy had jean shorts on, and it was raining at the time.
Oh, I think I've seen it. I think I've seen it. Yeah. And, the whole thing is a different look for you. It's a different look for you.
It's a very Philadelphia look, isn't it, Nas?
Yeah, it is. It is. All right. So the PGA Championship is up and running, and I'm just looking at what went on yesterday. Brooks Koepka, no one is ever going to mistake him for, I don't know, you know, like a stand-up comedian or somebody that really entertains a room. He's not going to be emceeing a fundraiser, but the man can play some golf. Mike, he goes out and shoots a 63. And Tony, I'm not sure if you had a chance to look at the current leaderboard, but I just updated it. And, of course, Koepka tees off, I believe, at 149. And, you know, right off the bat, before he even goes out there, his lead is already up to 3 strokes over Dustin Johnson, 4 strokes over Daniel Berger. What do you make of Koepka's first round? Is that sort of a signal that, you know what, I wait for the big ones, and I gear up for these, and you're going to all be chasing me come Sunday?
Yeah, you look at his last 7 starts, Christopher, and all he's done in those is win 3 majors. So he is the underrated superstar golf doesn't seem to want to promote. It's really weird. You and I have been talking about Brooks Koepka for, I would say, no less than a year, and nobody wants to give him his credit, the due justice that this man is, because you're right, he doesn't have the bubbling personality of a Ricky Fowler, or he doesn't stir stuff up kind of like Patrick Reed, and he's not golf's golden child like Jordan Spieth. But what he is he's the best player on the planet outside of maybe Dustin Johnson, and Dustin Johnson's off to a great start this morning as well. It seems to me that all he had to do yesterday was shoot or tie the best round in a major in history and set the course record at Bethpage Black for people to finally go, wait a minute. This guy is really good, and it's not just he won the U.S. Open last year shooting 2 over par, and he kind of came out of nowhere to win last year's PGA Championship. He's won 3 majors in his last 7 starts, like I mentioned, and it seems to almost go as it's Brooks Koepka. He plays really well in major championships. He went into the weekend as the defending champion at 15-1. So I don't know if Brooks has to come out and rattle off a Tiger Slam or what he has to do to get the attention and the justice that his name deserves, but he's doing everything he can right now to do that.
You know, we're talking with Tony Landry, my good friend who's a regular on this program and doing a little extra duty for us this week. We missed him earlier in the week. Tony, of course, produces Big Ten this morning for Sirius XM. You know, Tony, I was trying to think of a good parallel. I think you've laid out kind of who Brooks Koepka is and the fact that golf doesn't really seem to promote him. I think you laid that out beautifully. It reminds me a little bit of a player that I'm going to go back a little bit. Bobby Jones, when he played on the Sixers with Julius Erving and that team that won the title, beating the Lakers, just blowing out the Lakers, and I think it was 82. Bobby Jones was the best defensive player in the NBA. He was an incredibly productive offensive player. This is a guy that was, you know, that would shut down whoever the team needed to shut down. He did it, but he was a soft-spoken, quiet North Carolina guy. He was very happy being in the background. And I wonder sometimes if because Koepka isn't this, I mean, he is who he is. He's an amazing golfer, but he's not this dynamic, engaging presence that people are going to be, you know, rushing to television to see, like a Tiger, or for that matter, like a Phil Mickelson. I just wonder if that's part of the reason that they've not gotten behind him. It makes no sense to me because ultimately the game is the thing, is it not?
You know, it's kind of funny that you say that because people don't give Brooks the credit for the order that he actually is. Because if you listen to him speak, there's not a lot of energy, there's not a lot of laughter, but what he's saying is very crucial to golf in that he's been very outspoken against a lot of things that golf needs to fix or needs to address, and people just kind of, you know, it's Brooks. He's, you know, he's just kind of giving his Wednesday press conference, but he's admitted before where he thinks the pace of play in golf is ridiculous. He thinks the fact that it takes 5.5 hours to go out and play a round of golf on a Sunday is utterly absurd, and he's even admitted to when he plays with somebody like a Kevin Na or insert very slow-moving golfer here, that he'll actually slow his play down to the point where he gets him and his playing partner put on the clock just so that person's forced to, like, be sped back up, and then he goes about playing his normal speed again. He's talked about how some of the commentators, like Ian Brandel Chambly, if you want to do some funny research, go ahead and look up their relationship. They hate each other, and they're not very soft-spoken about it. Brandel actually was quoted yesterday on Twitter saying, it's like he went around and gave me the finger for 4.5 hours because Brandel said he didn't have the game to play at Bethpage Black. And like we mentioned before, all he did was go out and shoot 63. But he's a guy that speaks his mind and isn't afraid to outright say, I played bad, or after the Ryder Cup, we played terribly. We weren't the best team this week. And it's a situation where he doesn't really get the front page headlines where a Phil Mickelson or a Tiger Woods, if they said it would, but with another win, he'll be one major championship behind Phil Mickelson and Rory McIlroy. So I think it's time the golf world, like we've talked about, and like you mentioned, probably needs to realize what we're watching right now.
You laid out something there that's really interesting because I'm the golf watcher. I'm not the player. You're both. You're excellent. You're an excellent observer of the game, and you're an excellent player. I understand pace of game when you're talking basketball, when you're talking what the Warriors do when they go on a 13-0 run in 2 minutes, when you're talking pace of play in hockey in terms of the teams that try to muck it up at center ice, you can't really do a lot of that anymore, versus the teams that are really trying to turn it around and get in transition and get odd man rushes or what have you. But when it comes to golf, it's not something I understand. So help me out here. The pace of play, can a player, as you just laid out, really change the ebb and flow of a tournament or ruffle somebody else's feathers by simply slowing down or speeding up?
You know, I'll give you a couple of examples there. Let's go back to, I think it was 2015 when Jordan Spieth won the British Open. He absolutely snapped slices a drive into essentially a Titleist club fixing car. Spent 31 minutes getting rulings, getting line of sight, doing everything he could while Matt Kuchar, his playing partner, was one stroke back. Matt Kuchar has gone on record and talked about how that slowed everything down and it lost all sense of rhythm for him. Jordan Spieth is a notoriously slow golfer. Backs off shots, brings Michael Greller, his caddy, in to have him look at things. And people don't really talk about that because people love Jordan Spieth. You have guys like that. You have guys like Kevin Na. You have guys like Sergio Garcia that can grind rounds to a halt with indecision, with club changes, with all sorts of different ruling askings, and just genuinely taking way too long to hit a golf shot. If you went out and played a round of golf like those guys played at your local Fresno Municipal Golf Course, they kick you off the course for taking too long. And it's a situation that golf hasn't really addressed because nobody really knows how to tell elite golfers hey, play faster or we're going to start docking you strokes. Because they're not really doing anything wrong in the sense of, you know, they're cheating or they're doing anything that's out of the rule book. They just take way too long because there are certain things in golf that they just won't accept. If golf were to go to something like, say, a Sky Caddy or a GPS system for the caddies to use, so they could say, okay, it's 187 yards, and then they figure out the slope or the distance, you know, the adjusted distance, you'd speed rounds of golf up by 45 minutes. Because then you wouldn't see Patrick Reed and his caddy looking at their yardage book for 5 minutes in between every shot, and then having them come up two club shorts going, well, that didn't do what we wanted it to. And it's a situation where if your playing partner doesn't play to the speed you do, golfers get frustrated because then they have to slow everything they do down, waiting on the other guy. Or Brooks Koepka, I listened to an interview on a podcast he did yesterday. He said really all he does is he has his caddy give him the yardage, he tells him where the miss is, and then he just gets up and he has about three different swings he picks from, and he goes out and hits it. And I'm sure that's probably a little generic in how well he actually approaches the game. But if you look at him, he plays a big cut, he knows how to play a draw, and he outdrives everybody by about 30 yards on every swing. So there's a rhythm and a pace he doesn't need. He just needs to know how far to hit it.
So this is interesting because you talk about rhythm and pace, and I know that when we used to watch golf when I was a kid, I remember only watching some of the majors. That's what we saw. And when you had the Arnold Palmers, the Jack Nicklauses, the Billy Caspers, and then you know later on the Lee Trevinos and so on, the game moved faster. Baseball also moved faster. You had games that were 2 hours and 10 minutes, 2 hours and 15 minutes. I'll even weave Shakespeare into this, and I'm being quite serious. In the original Shakespearean productions, you know, which are written in five acts, but they're done with two acts. They combine two in one, three in the other. Those shows, back in Shakespeare's day, took 2 hours plus. Today, Tony, they take 3.5 hours, 3 hours and 45 minutes because actors are taking too many liberties with the lines. They're putting in too many phony pauses. And to roll this back into baseball and golf now, do you find it interesting that there is this parallel with baseball, that the game is taking too long, and instead of players simply staying in the box, pitchers not waving off every single sign, not having endless trips to the mound, baseball is trying to come up with artificial ideas, artificial methods of moving the game forward to get into our remote control society and shaving a half an hour off a game or whatever it is. There is an interesting parallel there, but I'm not sure that you can do anything about golf except what you just said, and that is telling players, play faster.
Yeah, I mean, you used to be able to set your watch. Greg Maddux hit the mound in Chicago, and you were done an hour and 45 minutes later.
Yes.
And he did it 89 pitches. You know, that was what WGN-TV was in my youth, and it was fantastic. In golf, you have, one, you have too many commercials, and that's on CBS and NBC, but I get that's a network thing where they're trying to make their bottom dollar because you need a Rolex commercial, an ED commercial, and a car commercial every 45 seconds. However, in golf, you run into this, it's almost, like Jordan Spieth, and I hate to be picking on Jordan Spieth because I actually like him, but he is, because he's very vocal, he's on the golf course, he and Michael Griller will switch clubs two or three times before they pick an 8-iron. And then he'll miss a shot by 30 yards. He'll hit the green, and he'll be going, well, where's the wind? Knock it down, wind. Move it, wind. When he really just hit a bad shot. And then it's overreading a putt. And if you do that 18 holes, you're just going to grind things to a halt. And it's not to say that they shouldn't be given the liberty to read putts and try to figure out clubs, because we're talking about millions of dollars that are on the line here in every tournament now. And I think that's the biggest thing with these guys, where if you look and you miss a putt and you go from solo third to tied for fifth, you may have given up $210,000 out of your total winnings. So I understand why these guys want to do that. But when you talk about a major championship Sunday, and this year was a little different on the Masters because the round got moved up. But if you're on the East Coast like I am, the round starts at 2:30 or 3 o'clock. you're looking at a 7:30 to 8 o'clock finish. And that's for anybody to try to block off that much of their time to watch that big of a sport is kind of ridiculous. And it's really, it's a fixable thing by giving them some advantages that golf is the sport, in my opinion, and you and I talk about this a lot on your program, that's too stuck in their ways.
Yes.
It's too old school, curmudgeon-y. I don't want, you know, John Daly got a golf cart this week, and you would have thought he was asking to play with three clubs at one time. You know, if it was something as simple as, hey, you're a defending champion, you get a lifetime exemption into this, you can barely walk without the assistance of a golf cart around to 18 holes. Well, John, sorry, we don't allow golf carts. We also don't allow shorts. And for a really long time, we didn't even allow women. So you better give us a damn good reason why. They could go out and fix things, but their angry man yells at cloud and shakes fist in air when it comes to ever changing anything. Because Jack and Arnie and, you know, a lot of those guys, you know, old Tom Morris didn't get these advantages. Well, they also didn't get to play with metal gloves. And you let guys do that now. So I think there are some very easy things golf could do to make their sport a little more TV-friendly and a little more quick-paced. It just comes down to the PGA Tour admitting they need to change things.
Well, it's a phrase that I've brought up to you many times when you and I have spoken and when you and I work together, and it's a phrase that gets me nuts, Tony, and it's the old, well, this is the way we've always done things. And as if to, mm-hmm. you know, to suggest that because that's the way we've always done things, there really shouldn't be any need to evolve or move forward. You know, we evolve and grow societally in every imaginable way, from technology to medicine, and you would think to sports, certainly to sports uniforms and the way stadiums are built and the way games are played, but golf seems to be stuck in the, you know, and I'm going overboard here, but in the days of Ben Hogan. It was good then in the 1940s, and it's good now. Last question for you. Tony, we've gone 19 minutes, almost 19 minutes, and not mentioned Tiger Woods. He's.
I think that's our personal best.
Is this going to be anything? He's two over. He's nine off the pace. Is this just going to be something that he's like, you know what, will he get to a point where if he doesn't close any ground at all, it's only the second round, but it's the cut day, will he just say, yeah, you know, I'll just play through and get ready for the next one? Or will he use today as something to work on this or work on that? Because I know that yesterday, the big deal with him was that he was 0-for-5 on putts between 5 and 10 feet. And that's something that was giving him trouble before, you know, the putting game. And then it was, of course, brilliant for him in the Masters.
Yeah, this comes down to him making the weekend or not. If he makes the weekend and he's 13 back, you're going to see Tiger Woods try some U.S. Open shots, try to figure out some stuff for maybe the next tournament he's playing in. Players Championship is coming up. You're going to see some guys do some stuff where, yeah, they're in the tournament and they made the weekend, but Tiger Woods is very much living in the glow of I won the Masters. This is the first time he's played since Augusta. So his game inevitably wasn't going to be as sharp as it probably needed to be coming into this kind of a weekend. This is a course that calls for some accuracy, and Tiger Woods has never been the world's most accurate guy off the tee. He proved that yesterday. You're going to see him try to make some putts, try to do some stuff. He's going to try to work on some stuff if he is, in fact, you know, making the weekend. I think it's going to be interesting to see how TV plays out with Tiger Woods not in contention. In a major, they already had a hard enough time getting people to watch. There's a reason this tournament went from the fourth major to the second major. It was because people were just tuning out, and they were getting ready for football season.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to see with him possibly being, you know, a fringe, you know, the 3 o'clock start time, and by 3:45 you're seeing Tiger walk up the 18th, probably isn't going to help coverage. But it's going to be interesting to see what his weekend beholds if he, in fact, does make it. He has an interesting stat. If you look at his major championship and even his PGA career, he eats up par fives. He's a something like 70 under
Wow.
in major tournaments
Wow.
and par fives, and he's over par on the rest. And I believe he finished even par. No, he did have an eagle yesterday, on a par five, and there's only two on the course, which is going to make things a little difficult for Tiger Woods if he does make the weekend, if he's not playing the par fives well. So I learned a long time ago to not put my foot in my mouth when it comes to Tiger Woods. So I wouldn't say that the chances of him winning are all that great. The chances of him making the weekend if he goes out and plays well are they're very much there. It'll all come down to, like you said, if he can get his putter hot. If he starts putting well, and of course, like Beth Page, he's got a chance to at least make him make his name known.
Well, I'm with you in the golf cart there. I wrote Woods off. We both did it together a couple of times on the program, and he certainly made a fool of me. Very quickly, before I let you go, would you play nine holes? Would you even play one hole with me if I was wearing, say, you know, like a hockey jersey or a football jersey?
I'll play all 18 holes with you if we do it in, say, I don't know, mid-July, early August in Fresno. It'll be nice and breezy.
Yeah, there is no breeze here. There's
it'll be 102 and you'll be in a hockey jersey. What could go wrong?
Yeah, exactly right. Folks, he is my good friend Tony Landry, the producer of Big Ten This Morning on Sirius XM Channel 372. Tony, always a great pleasure. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll check in with you next week.
Sounds good, my friend, and always fun being on the CGP.
Appreciate your patronage and your contributions, as always. This is the CGP.
There may be no busier film critic, no greater elite movie mind than Nick Shager. He can talk Hollywood, Cannes, Sundance, Fargo, Budapest, Kathmandu. If there's a film to be seen or a film festival to attend, he is on it. Here's Nick Shager.
Always fun to see Nick coming down the aisle, the black tux. He's taken off the green bow tie for the Celtics, and he's put on the navy blue bow tie for the Yankees. He's like that. How are you, Nick?
I'm good. How are you this Friday, Christopher?
Well, I'm doing very well. We're geared up for game four of the San Jose Sharks St. Louis Blues series. The Sharks are only a couple of games away from getting to the Stanley Cup final. Against the Boston Bruins. Are you a hockey fan? I've asked you this before, and I've forgotten.
Yeah, I'm not a big hockey fan. I sort of pay attention every now and again as it gets closer to to the finals. But I really confine myself to basketball, baseball, football, and the occasional fight.
All right, gotcha. John Wick, Chapter 3, Parabellum. Now, I have tried to get into this series. I've watched them, and for me, this has become, the trailer has been better than the movie. You are a big John Wick franchise lover. Please tell me, A, how this version is, this new one, and B, what am I missing that I've not gotten sort of dialed into it yet?
Well, you're right to say that I am a big John Wick guy. I'm a big Keanu Reeves guy. In fact, I have a big piece in the Daily Beast today that really sort of just extols the virtues of Keanu in general, obviously timed to John Wick 3 Parabellum, which comes out today. For me, I always felt that the first John Wick was not only great, but a really great self-contained story. I mean, it was about a guy who's dragged out of retirement because these guys kill his dog, which came from his recently deceased wife, and he goes on this mission of revenge. And it was a really self-contained piece. And I never really thought there was a need to go back to the well, because there was nowhere further to go. Everything had sort of been explored enough. Everything had been hinted at in a nice way. But, you know, the dictates of franchise filmmaking don't necessarily care about those kinds of wishes. So we got John Wick Chapter 2 a couple of years ago, and I thought that was a really, really virtuoso piece of action filmmaking, even if the story's a little shakier. Same can be said about John Wick Chapter 3, but I will tell you, if you love the series like I do, Chapter 3 is actually better than Chapter 2, and I think there are two reasons for it. One, the action is even better somehow. They do so much unbelievably inventive stuff. The choreography here is really just above and beyond. There are sequences. There's a sequence with Boban, I never can pronounce his last name, Marjanovic from the 76ers, who fights Keanu early on in the film. There's a sequence where he's on horseback in Manhattan. There's a knife fight that you have to see to believe. all sorts of amazing stuff. And then the narrative is a much more streamlined affair, so there isn't as much excess stuff. It's basically John Wick's on the run, contract on his head internationally, so every assassin in the world is trying to kill him, and he has to figure out a way to survive this. Holly Berry helps out in a supporting role. There's just so much good action, and Keanu is still so good in it that if you love the series, you're going to love it. Now, if you don't, as you were saying, there's nothing new here that is going to win you over. I think it's a matter of whether or not, you know, people like really ultraviolent action that's done in a really, I think, expertly choreographed way. There's really a lot of craft behind it, and that's what appeals to me as much as the actual violence itself. There's a real creativity to these long, long action set pieces. But as I said, you know, mileage will vary. This isn't a film I would recommend to my mother, per se, because she wouldn't take to a lot of knives to the head and gunshot wounds and the like. But if that is your cup of tea, this is the movie to see this weekend.
Well, it is. I mean, it is a good cast. There's no doubt about that. I'm an Ian McShane fan, and certainly I like Lawrence Fishburne and Keanu. I kind of go back and forth on. Is this a franchise? Do you see this now that we're at this third one? Is this something that's going to be like Transformers, where you and I will be talking in 5 years, and we'll be talking about John Wick Chapter 16?
Well, you know, there is a question about how long, you know, anything should really last, and I think that's something we're going to talk about later, too.
Yeah, yes.
And when it comes to John Wick Chapter 3, you know, the film, just like Chapter 2, it really leaves things open-ended, so that there is a conclusion, but then there's a coda that you know, suggests a fourth movie. The fourth movie that it is implying would certainly work. It would include a lot more of Lawrence Fishburne and Ian McShane, who are both great. Lance Reddick, who's great. But, you know, there's a point at which I think you also feel like, you know, we've seen Wick now kill 8,000 people in about just about every way you can imagine. There is a little bit of repetitiveness creeping in here. And I think in the new one, the repetitiveness is almost used like to bludgeon you to the point where you're just exhausted by it and sort of amazed. But, you know, how many more of these do we need? I would argue that it's good to, you know, end when you're on top before you really start sacrificing fan goodwill.
It reminds me, as you're laying this out, it reminds me of, I can't remember if it was Showtime, but I watched every episode. Do you remember the series, The Tudors?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, how many beheadings did we have to watch? you know, I mean, it was fascinating, and I thought, as somebody who knows Henry VIII pretty well, they really stayed fairly accurate to the story of him, his wives, his kingdom, and so on. But after a while, it was wearing me down between watching people getting beheaded, drawn and quartered, tortured. It was just too much. So I think sometimes,
yeah.
Go ahead. It gets
no. I was going to say you're right. Films and TV shows and books and book series, they all have lifespans, and I think that the best ones know when to quit. You know, there's nothing worse than watching something or reading something that you love just sort of go on and on for the sake of it. You know, the big example I think a lot of culture critics would use is The Simpsons,
yes,
which everybody loved and which was great for, you know, quite a few years and then has continued on, you know, endlessly. I think we're the 25th or 26th season. And I don't think anybody watches it anymore. I certainly don't think anyone thinks it's nearly as funny as it used to be. And I think that's, you know, depressing to see something great just, you know, not know when to cede the stage. So, you know, better to put an end point on it and move on to new ventures.
And yet the whole Simpson family hasn't aged. They look great.
Fantastic.
Yeah. We're talking with Nick Shager, a wonderful film critic for the Daily Beast, Variety, Yahoo Movies, Esquire, and certainly other publications. You, when Nick Shager raves over something, and I look at a review and at the headline bar, A Star is Born, Hollywood's Next Big Thing, it might be the movie of the year. You get my attention. And the movie that we're talking about is The Souvenir. The actress we're talking about is Anna Swinton Byrne. It looks pretty fascinating. You loved this.
I did. And I was doubly surprised that I loved it that much because of the filmmaker's prior works. It's made by a British filmmaker named Joanna Hogg, who's made three previous features. And I like the first two of her features, and the third one, the most recent, which was called Exhibition from a couple of years ago, I absolutely couldn't stand. I just thought it was the most, it was sort of the epitome of what people think of as a pretentious art house film. I just thought it had gone too far stylistically. So her new movie, The Souvenir, which comes out today in limited release, I went into with a little bit of trepidation. But as you said, it's great. I think it is just a great movie. And I think it's a really unconventional movie that sort of appeals to an adult audience but has a wider, I think, you know, I think it has a potential to reach a wider audience than that because of what the story is about. It's about a young woman played by Honor Swinton Byrne, who's a relative newcomer, and she's actually Tilda Swinton's daughter in real life. And she plays her daughter in this movie. And she's a 20-something Londoner who is an aspiring filmmaker and winds up in a relationship with a young man, or a man who seems to be a little bit older than her, who, you know, sort of captivates her because he seems very worldly and very knowing and very supportive and sort of, you know, like, you know, the kind of guy you meet that's just a little bit more mature than you, and you're sort of enraptured,
yeah,
not only by that maturity, but by the idea that he's interested in you. And the film is this really unconventional sort of portrait of their relationship and the ups and downs of it. And I say it's unconventional because one of the things Hogg does is she's not really interested in the what I sort of referred to in my Daily Beast piece as the in-between stuff of drama. She likes to jump into scenes sort of in the middle of a conversation and let you catch up with it and let you catch up with the important stuff, and then moves on maybe to a scene from a day later or a few days later or a week later, and really hones in on the important things relative to the evolution of their relationship. It's not spoiling anything to say that the relationship winds up becoming more troubled because of revelations about him, but also because through the relationship, she really does sort of come of age. And so there's this really beautiful dynamic between both the actors. Byrne is, in particular, just absolutely fantastic in the film. And the film itself, unlike Hogg's prior one, is really well modulated to its characters. It really does understand them and attunes itself to them in this really sharp way. I just found it entrancing and really, really incisive about the way relationships, especially, you know, relationships in your 20s when you're first an adult and first sort of, you know, experiencing a lot of these things and trying to find your voice both professionally and, you know, romantically and personally. I found it really, really smart. And so I think that, you know, people who are looking for something that is a little bit more substantive dramatically will get a lot out of it. It's going to be, I'm sure, on my, you know, top 15 or 20 list or whatever I, you know, it winds up being at the end of the year. If you're looking for maybe the top film of this weekend and you don't want to see people get their heads blown off endlessly with John Wick, this is the one to see.
One of the great things about you being a sports fan is that I can throw sports parallels at you, and you totally, I don't lose you, because I lose a lot of people. Here's the thing about this young actress. It's her debut. She's had a couple of teeny other things, but this is essentially her debut, and it reminds me a little bit, you know, considering that the film, the script, the story, everything is wonderful, and she's got the chops. It all comes together to create a great, say, a debut piece for her. But how much of this is luck of the draw? And what I'm getting at here is I'm thinking about a guy like Tom Brady. He gets drafted in the sixth round, 199th pick. He goes to New England, and all the pieces come together with Bill Belichick and what have you, and he becomes, you know, the greatest quarterback. I don't think it's even arguable in history in terms of what he's accomplished. But sometimes you wonder, what if he was picked up by the Bengals? What if he was picked up, by the then Houston Oilers or what have you? And in the case of this young actress, how much of her stunning performance is the fact that she also was the beneficiary of great material and it being beautifully directed?
No, you're right, 100%. I think a lot of acting careers and creative careers, just like athletic careers, are not just a byproduct of talent. There are a lot of talented people in the world. And even if we're going to say we're going to set aside all of the most talented people in the world who have star potential, who have greatness potential in them, it's still a matter of, the luck of the draw and circumstance. Here, Byrne is very fortunate that her mother, Tilda Swinton, had actually worked with Joanna Hogg, the director, like 30 years ago on one of Hogg's early short films, and they had a relationship. And at the same time, she's coming up as an actress. Hogg is looking to make a film which, as I said, is about a woman who's also a filmmaker, a budding filmmaker, so there's an autobiographical element. Byrne is at the right age when Hogg wants to make this film. They already know each other because of family connections. She's talented. Hogg is in the right place. Everything comes together. It could just as easily go the other way. There are a lot of factors in, and your analogy with Tom Brady makes total sense. Tom Brady is great, and I think he would have been very, very good anywhere. But, some people get real lucky and find their, soulmates, so to speak, and Bill Belichick and the like. And, Bill Belichick, too, is just as lucky that he got Tom Brady. I mean, Belichick is a genius, and I'm not taking anything away from it. But it's hard to win championships when you don't have a great quarterback. Phil Jackson, Red Auerbach, everybody. These things are the luck of the draw. So sometimes you get lucky, but certainly that's not to downplay the fact that all these people are extremely talented on their own.
No, there's no question. And I'm glad you added that, because that's certainly not to undercut her. I mean, you get the right material, you get the right director, everything goes right. But if you don't have, in this case, the acting chops to pull it off, we won't hear from you again. It's really that simple. Nick Shager joining me, as he always does on Fridays, from the Daily Beast, Variety, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire. A Dog's Journey, sequel to the 2017 A Dog's Purpose. Listen, I like dogs. I like cats. I don't like movies about dogs or cats. Should I go see this?
The answer, I think, is pretty clearly no. If you don't like dogs and you don't like animal movies, A Dog's Journey, just like A Dog's Purpose, is not going to do anything for you. And like you, I'm a pet person. I don't have any dogs currently, but I do have a few cats. And this is the kind of film that just immediately leaves me cold. Now, I know there is a big audience for it. A Dog's Purpose did quite well at the box office, which is why we have a sequel. It's based on best-selling novels. And so people who liked the first movie certainly are going to like the second, because it is more or less the same film. Its predecessor, A Dog's Journey is about a dog who keeps getting reincarnated in various other dogs. And all of those dogs wind up being, owned by a main human character. In this case, Dennis Quaid, it's Dennis Quaid's character from the first film. His daughter winds up with their dog, or the spirit of their dog, who keeps getting reincarnated in all of her dogs throughout her life. So the film charts how the dog helps influence her life when she's a kid, when she's a young adult, when she's trying to be a professional, when she's trying to have a family. Helps her through all sorts of crises, some of which are positive, some of which are negative. There's some weird incidents, actually, in the film that the film sort of is not serious enough to tackle, especially a sort of stalkerish thriller subplot. But really, if you're looking for a film in which Josh Gad, the actor, voices a dog in a very cute way and makes lots of quips as he helps the human sort of, deal with love and professional hurdles. Right. This is your film. For me, I really had a tough time even paying a lot of attention to it, because it's just too treacly and too sappy for me. It's too corny. But if you're, other people, I think, have a greater threshold for what we might call wholesome cinema like this. And, if you're into it, A Dog's Journey is not going to, certainly not going to disappoint you if you loved A Dog's Purpose. I just don't think it has a great appeal outside of that niche audience.
No, exactly. And, the fact is, another reason to go see it is, if you're a Dennis Quaid lover, and you and I just talked in the last couple of weeks about Dennis, a creepy Dennis Quaid, Now you get sappy Dennis Quaid.
You do. Although he's not in the film as much as you'd think, because he really sort of cedes the stage, so to speak, to his to the woman playing his daughter, or the women playing his daughter, because there are a number of them as she gets older. And look, you know, everybody is fine in it. Josh Gad certainly does his best, you know, voicing the character. And the dog, there are lots of cute dog reaction shots. So if you're into that, look, there is a real audience for it. We know on by the internet alone that there are, you know, the biggest thing in the world is watching animal videos. So, you know, you could do worse.
Well, we're going to do better with one more thing, and we're going to bookend this show today. We started the program talking about Game of Thrones and weaving in football and endings and why people don't like when shows end, or sometimes people do like it. We're going to get some thoughts on Game of Thrones, and the final episode is coming up on Sunday from, we can go ahead and call him Mr. Game of Thrones, Nick Shager. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
One more thing today is about one more episode Sunday. It is the eighth and final season of Game of Thrones. We have arrived at that moment where people will be having watch parties in bars. I've seen watch parties with the show projected onto the side of a building and probably 500 to 1,000 people there. And I was saying earlier, Nick, that people in this building, there are as many who are just almost vitriolically anti-Game of Thrones. I think it's kind of the way that people hate soccer. You know, if you either love it or if you don't like it, you have to come out and talk about it and let everybody know that you don't like it. What do you make of this series, the phenomenon, and do you agree with me that we will see some sort of spinoff or version of this in the next couple of years?
Well, as for Game of Thrones, I do think, you know, one of the really unique things about it is you would think in this era of splintered media where everybody has 8 million channels and streaming services and the internet allows you to just look at the stuff you're interested in, which is sort of, I think, fragmented everything. It's amazing that Game of Thrones is still this really big national and really international phenomenon. I mean, it's the biggest show here in this country and it's the biggest show in the world. And it is dominating the cultural conversation the last few weeks. Last week's episode, which fans certainly were watching, polarized people. And I think there's been a lot of surprising brushback on this season, in part because people, I think, feel that the show, not only they don't want it to end, but it's been a bit rushed. They've cut some corners. They've done a lot of narrative stuff, I think, to get to a finale. And I think that's been a problem, given that they were offered to do the show for far longer. And the showrunners decided not to. So this Sunday, we're going to get the big finale. We're going to get the big answers. I'm sure it's not going to please everybody. But as to your question about whether or not we're going to have spinoffs, one of the rumored spinoffs is apparently dead as of now, but I suspect that we're going to eventually see some sort of prequel series, you know, in the coming years. It won't be from these showrunners, though, because they have already announced that they are now going to be spearheading the new Star Wars trilogy starting in about 3 years. So they'll be on to new supernatural fantasy horizons, but you know, Game of Thrones, I do suspect it's going to live on past this Sunday.
We've got about a minute left. Is it because of moving on to the Star Wars trilogy and all the pre-production and what have you that these showrunners decided not to extend this one more year? Because everybody that I talk to say exactly what you just did, that it's been a rushed final season. Contrived may not be the right word, but at times it's been that, and things haven't made sense. And now you've got the change.org petition of over 350,000 names on it, wanting them to reshoot the whole season. Obviously, they don't understand how this all works. That's not going to happen. What do you make of that? We got about a minute.
I think that stuff's crazy, and you're right. They don't seem to understand the immense operation that went into making this season. This is the biggest season of television, production-wise, ever. I think that the problem here has been really the fact that the books that they're based on, written by George R.R. Martin, you know, they surpassed the books. Martin hasn't finished the last two books, and so he wound up having to give them outlines for how to finish it, and they've gone about doing that, but they've done it in a much more narrative sense. If you want to really blame someone, I think the blame, if anywhere, goes to Martin. I mean, he couldn't figure out, and still hasn't been able to figure out, how to end the story. So they had to figure it out themselves, and I think, relatively speaking, they've done a fine job, even if it's not as great, maybe, as the original episodes.
Well, that's a great summation. Listen, he is Nick Shager. We love him. Daily Beast, Variety, Yahoo Movies, Esquire. Nick, have a great weekend. Go ride a dragon, and we'll talk next week.
Looking forward to it. Have a good one, Christopher.
All right. My thanks to Mr. Shager, along with Tim Kuhn from ESPN The Magazine and Tony Landry from SiriusXM, and my guy Russ doing his usual great job. Folks, have a great weekend. Congratulations to Fresno State Baseball winning the Mountain West regular season championship. We will see you on Monday at 3:05. Until then, you're on your own.